Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations in New York's Zuccotti Park and speak with the author of a new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University, where he's also a professor of law at Harvard Law School, joins us from the demonstrations to discuss whether, as he hopes, the movement will spread to occupy K Street, the lair of the lobbyists in our nation's capital, and Main Street. Then we will look into how unions and other progressive organizations are joining in with this spontaneous and grassroots protest movement, Occupy Wall Street. Les Leopold, a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations, joins us to discuss whether an authentic, non-hierarchical populist movement is forming to counter the repackaging of America's right wing as the Tea Party, a largely astroturf movement guided by political pros Karl Rove and Dick Armey and funded by the Koch brothers. Then finally, we will talk with a Syrian human rights activist about the Russian and Chinese veto in the United Nations Security Council of tougher sanctions against the murderous Assad regime. Radwan Zihadeh, the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies, joins us to discuss the likelihood of the Syrian opposition taking up arms and fighting back against the regime from sanctuaries in Iraq and Turkey. And just in terms of breaking news, there is the unfortunate news that co-founder of Apple, Steve Jobs, died just a short time ago at the age of 57. And on a somewhat ridiculous note, Sarah Palin just announced that she is not running for president, that she and her husband Todd will devote ourselves to God, family, and country. Let's now go to Zuccotti Park. Joining us now is Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Previously, Lawrence Lessig was a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the University of Chicago Law School. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. He is the author of a new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. He joins us now from the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations in Zuccotti Park. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Lessig.
Glad to be here.
And give us a flavor. I don't mean to recruit you as our reporter, but that's essentially what we're doing.
Yeah, so the park is just about full now. It's packed mainly with, you know, 20-somethings or 30-somethings, but there's a whole bunch of suits who are walking through, a whole bunch of great handmade posters as well as some printed posters, and a lot of people just building a camp. So in the center, there's a line that separates places where people are sleeping. There's a kind of food co-op that's been set up. The Root Strikers group just brought in about a couple thousand bottles of water for people to drink. So it's really beginning to take off as a rally, and it's a beautiful, amazingly beautiful New York day for it. So I'm sure it's going to have a lot of people here when the rally takes off.
And do you believe that this is the beginning of we've already seen a populist movement get a lot of attention in this country, the Tea Party, largely propelled by outrage over Wall Street. However, it's been seems to have been co-opted, at least guided by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey, who managed to get a lot of congressmen elected and take over the Congress. And also there's been funding from the oligarchs like the Koch brothers. Could it be now that a real, authentic populist movement is emerging in the United States?
I think there's a potential for that. I think a lot depends upon how people here allow their story to be told. This is much more important than what happened in Madison. Because in Madison, the only way to understand that fight was a fight between Republicans and Democrats. And I was clearly on the side of the Democrats, and I clearly loved what was happening. But it wasn't a fight that was going to unite anybody in a way that was going to change anything substantial. But the fight here, focused on Wall Street, should be a fight about the corruption in the political system, the way in which money from Wall Street basically bought the regulatory environment that brought the collapse of 2008. And worse than that, after 2008, the money from Wall Street blocked any effective reform. The first time in American history when, after a financial disaster, we didn't see any substantial financial reform. And so people on the left and people on the right should be able to rally behind that idea and that kind of populism, which says that, you know, we shouldn't have a government that's run for the elites or by the elites. And if this community here allows that to be the message that explains why this protest is so important, and as I wrote in a piece for Huffington Post today, we imagine Occupy Wall Street, moving to Occupy K Street, and then moving to Occupy Main Street, so that we don't have to alienate anybody to build them into this movement. And I do think there's an enormous potential for this to be the beginnings of a real populist change that could change the way American government works.
Well, it seems already framing this around a simple message that it's the 99% versus the 1% seems to be that should have resonance. And I wonder, do you believe that this country is based upon a kind of sense of fair play and fairness, or are we such in the thrall of the billionaires that we're all thinking that we're going to win the lottery and it's okay? I mean, I don't know where the moral center is anymore, but I would think...
So I think that the danger to the 99% rhetoric is that it gets too easily cast by the right as class warfare. And... you know, I'd be happy to have class warfare, but I don't think it's actually productive. I think that the way to understand the 99% is that the 1% has corrupted the system to protect themselves. And that is a true story, and it's a true fair complaint, and it really is about the fairness inside of democracy of allowing the 1% to use their enormous wealth to buy the political system in a way that protects exactly their interests and hurts the interests of everybody else. So if it's understood in that way, yeah, I think it's fine, and it's important, and its potential to rally people is huge. But my fear is that unless we get people to recognize the need to build this cross-partisan movement, the movement fails. Now, by cross-partisan, I don't mean moderates. I don't mean, you know, people on the left and people on the right have to learn to agree. It's more like, you know, we have to agree on the rules of the game, and nobody on the left or the right should look at this game and say that these rules are fair. So let's get fair rules, then let's play the political game and fight as hard as we can for whatever side we have.
Well, Lawrence Lessig, clearly there have been people like George Lakoff who've pointed out for some time that the right in this country is much better at framing things and in messaging. So if the 99% versus the 1% is not the right message, then surely then the right message is that our politics are about money and not about people. And if you make politics about money, then people with money own your politics. So let's make politics in this country not about money.
I agree. I think that's the right framing. And if it's framed in that way, emphasizing the corruption of this system, then I think neither side should oppose it. And when we've done polling of people on the right about this money issue, people on the right are just as furious about the kind of crony capitalism or corruption of the system as people on the left. So I think keeping it framed in that way helps people understand why this is so important.
But surely people feel powerless, Lawrence Lessig, given the Supreme Court decision that opened the floodgates for unlimited money. Now, they did open the floodgates for both corporations and unions, but there's no symmetry there between corporations and unions. So, and you've clerked for Antonin Scalia, who's on the Supreme Court, obviously. So you have a sense of that court. They did leave open the possibility for some kind of transparency about who gives money. But we know that the Congress tried to enact the Disclose Act, and that was shut down by the Republicans. So they know, clearly the Republicans know the benefits of unlimited corporate money. So how do you level that playing field?
Yeah, so it's absolutely right. The Supreme Court's made the problem worse. And transparency would be a good thing to have. But I actually think the Supreme Court decision's a distraction. And I don't think transparency solves any problem at all. If we had perfect transparency, people would be able to prove what we already know, that the system's corrupt. And if we reverse the Supreme Court decision, and went back to the way the world was before the Supreme Court decision, hey, the democracy was already broken the day before the Supreme Court decided Citizens United. So I think what we got to do is to focus reform in a way that could actually have an effect. And that means to support and find a way to leverage small-dollar-funded elections into our system so that politicians are not dependent upon a small, tiny subset of America to fund their elections. They have to look to all of us. And small-dollar-funded elections would dramatically change the way in which this Congress did its work. So I think that's the fundamental reform we have to find a way to push for and stop, you know, thinking that the Supreme Court is the only place where we get effective reform activity. We get effective reform activity by the old-fashioned way, by getting politicians to listen to what we demand.
Well, speaking of the old-fashioned way, Lawrence Lessig, I recall that Wisconsin Senator Proxmire, who was famous for the Golden Fleece Awards, he would only spend $500 on a Senate campaign, and he was continually reelected. So where's that magic? I mean, can you bottle that magic? Can we go back in time to that America?
No, we can't. We're not going to. People who want to run Proxmire's campaign lose. There are people who run that campaign. They're not taken seriously. Look, the most interesting Republican candidate for president is Buddy Romer, former governor from Louisiana, eight years in the United States House of Representatives. Buddy Romer is running a campaign where he says he's going to take no more than $100 from anybody, take no money from any PAC. And I disagree with just about every substantive issue he has, but obviously he thinks that the most important issue is the same issue I think is the most important, the corruption of the system. Yet people won't even listen to him because they're like, yeah, there's no way you can run a presidential campaign on $100 contributions. So, you know, the reality of this world is that we can't run or win elections without money in the political system, so we have to find a way to fund political systems that doesn't turn control over to the smallest and most elite members in the society. And that's why, you know, in my book, I talk about what I call a Grant and Franklin project that includes vouchers that would, you know, be vouchers for everybody, and that would make it possible to fund elections and small-dollar contributions. There are lots of suggestions like that out there. We just need to get people to focus on the core, the root problem here, which is the money in the system, and then find a way to strike at that root. You know, Henry David Thoreau, there are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one striking at the root. And what I'm trying to do is see whether we can get all these people around here hacking at branches of evil to recognize what the core problem here, what the root is.
Well, tell us a little bit about your book, Lawrence Lessig. I know you're there at Zuccotti Park, you're in a way you're seeing the expression of much of what you're trying to write about here in terms of political reform. At least there's the beginnings of perhaps a new vehicle to change the political landscape. But we're going to be talking in a couple of weeks when you come out here, and we'll obviously talk more at length. But just give our audience a little flavor of the book.
Yeah, so the book is called Republic Lost, and its basic argument is that, you know, people have a conception of corruption, which is like Rob Blagojevich or Randy Duke Cunningham, people like committing crimes by bribing politicians or politicians taking bribes. And that's not our democracy. That's not the problem we face. The problem we face is much more pervasive, much more obvious, in plain sight kind of corruption. And that's the way we fund campaigns and the way lobbyists use that system to leverage enormous power for their clients. And that reality produces enormous cynicism inside of our system. So 75% of people think money buys results in Congress, and that leads most people to say, why should I waste my time? And until we change that fundamental economy of influence, we're not going to get any progress either on the left or the right. I mean, I think this is the most important argument I'm trying to make in the book, that this is not a left-right issue. People on the left have obvious things that they want to get that are being blocked by special interest money, but people on the right, too. If you want smaller government, you're not going to have smaller government as long as a large government makes it easier to raise money, because large government means there are more chains for congressmen to pull every time they want to raise money. Or a simpler tax system, we have a complex tax system because that means there's a million people to call every time there's election just to raise money to keep whatever special tax benefit has gone into the system. So people on the left and the right have to recognize this way of funding elections is defeating their objectives. And if we could get a different way of funding elections, then we could begin to talk about how a democracy could work. So then I end by like mapping what that different system would be, but recognizing that this is an enormously difficult problem to solve because everybody inside the Beltway in Washington depends on this system surviving. And if we're going to change the system, we, you know, have to adopt strategies that are not inside the Beltway strategies. So I actually advanced in the end an argument in favor of a constitutional convention that is a system that the framers envisioned that Congress couldn't control as a way to build the reform that we need to get a change in the way Congress functions. So that's the basic argument of the book, but it's trying to lay out this plan for reform and finally quash, you know, the ridiculous skepticism that's out there about whether, in fact, we can say that our system's corrupt. Our system is corrupt. It's not the system our framers gave us. When the framers talked about Congress, they said it would be an institution, quote, dependent upon the people alone. And it's obviously clear that this system is not dependent upon the people alone. It's dependent upon the funders of elections. And those funders are obviously defending policy in a way that's corrupting the opportunity for democracy to function.
So, Lawrence Lessig, if this is a battle between the power of money and the power of people and the power of votes, and money has transcended the power of people, and I guess you're witnessing the at least a kind of nascent and inchoate movement of people coalescing down there where we're speaking to you now from the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations in Zuccotti Park next to Wall Street. Clearly, when you mentioned a minute ago the Beltway, it's more than just money. It's about connections. Yesterday, I did an interview with Friends of the Earth who uncovered through the Freedom of Information Act emails between a chief lobbyist for a Canadian oil pipeline that would go from the tar sands of Alberta across the United States to refineries in Texas. This fellow was the former deputy campaign manager for Hillary Clinton in her 2008 campaign, and now he's the chief lobbyist for the Canadians. So it's not just that the powerful in this country have gamed the system, because the relationship is so cozy that the State Department is not even exercising any oversight on the part of the people. They're telling these this oil company how to get, you know, get the permits and get it done, as opposed to you know, I mean, I wonder whether my reservoir for outrages has been tapped, but I must say this really got under my skin.
Yeah, you're right. It's about connections, but it's about connections that facilitate a certain kind of wealth or a certain kind of money. I think it's important to say this is not against money in the sense that people who should be in this movement are people who should hate, you know, the free market system or should hate capitalism. I mean, there are those people, a lot of them right here, who are arguing against capitalism as the problem. But the point isn't money. The point is corrupt money. The point is the way corrupt money corrupts capitalism and corrupts democracy. So, you know, when you've got companies out in Silicon Valley that, when I was out in San Francisco, who's starting a great new idea, they have some great idea that they want to take out to the marketplace, they don't spend their time in Washington lobbying because they just want to make something effective and make it work and make a lot of money from it. There's no problem with that. The problem is when that money gets channeled into the system so that you buy political advantage against your competitor, and that's what makes you rich. And so the insiders that have this influence game have produced what, you know, Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, says Capitol Hill has become this farm league for K Street. You know, basically everybody, members of Congress, lobbyists, bureaucrats.
I see.
Right
in the middle of the demonstration, right? Yeah.
So, you know, everybody, lobbyists, bureaucrats, staffers, they all want to live life in government so they can go and live life as a lobbyist because there's an enormous amount of money in that. And the money they get from that is wealthy because the system is able to deliver to the clients of the lobbyists what the clients pay for. So that's the corruption of the system. Money doesn't in its nature make it corrupt. It's just that we've allowed the system to be responsive to this kind of distortion from money, and that's the corruption that we ought to be fighting. So you could be free market libertarian and be as much upset about this corruption as somebody on the far left. And in fact, I had my favorite moment on the radio was when I was debating Richard Epstein, who is a famous right-wing libertarian economist lawyer from University of Chicago. And in the end, We agreed public funding of elections was the only way to end the corruption of the system, because he is as concerned with the way government corrupts the market as I'm concerned about the way the government doesn't help people who need to be helped in the right way. So that's the point. It's not about, you know, going to destroy the system. It's going to destroy the corruption, which is destroying the system.
And indeed, translating public service into private gain seems to be totally acceptable, and it clearly should not be acceptable. I thank you so much for joining us here today from the demonstrations of the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations at Anzucati Park, Lawrence Lessig, and for your new book, Republic Lost. And I look forward to talking with you more about it when you come to Los Angeles in a couple of weeks.
Great. It'll be a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Lessig, who's the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Previously, he was a professor of law at Stanford Law School and at the University of Chicago Law School. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. He is the author of a new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. He joined us from the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations in Zuccotti Park. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how unions and other progressive organizations are joining the Occupy Wall Street protest movement.
They want you lost in your own fear. No compass, find your way out. A troglodyte, a derelict barn. Pretend the filthy rich, the beggar's ditch, God damn.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Les Leopold, who co-founded and directs two non-profit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. Les Leopold is the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Les Leopold.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're just speaking then with Lawrence Lessig, who is at the Occupy Wall Street demonstration in Zuccotti Park. He, of course, has been working for a long time on campaign finance reform, getting money out of politics, and that is a part of an overall message. What do you take away from this? What do you think, Les? Is there a central message here?
Well, yeah, I think this is a populist moment. It's the 99% against the 1%. This is what I think could be the essence of a significant movement. And it's interesting that it took the kids to kind of get out there and get the ball rolling. We all have to be careful about reading in our issue into what's going on. But I think the broadest common denominator is people feel abused by the economic crisis and the way Wall Street basically got away with it, caused it, and is walking off scot-free. And I think an anti-Wall Street focus is precisely what we need.
And in terms of the unions that are joining and other progressive groups, what's your sense of how are they trying to co-opt it, or are they trying to catch up to it?
Oh, I that's hard to say. I mean, the question is whether these other groups, the unions and churches and community groups, have the staying power to continue showing up. There are like, you know, maybe 20, 25,000 people there today, which is great, but can we do it every week? Can we support all the groups in the other cities all across the country? Can labor show up in a consistent way? That remains to be seen. or will they fall back into their usual kind of routine in supporting Democrats in the upcoming elections? I think what's very interesting is I've been making this argument for a while that what's holding progressives back is 30 years of balkanized politics. Each of us were into our own specific issue, you know, women's issues, minority issues, labor, environment, and on and on and on. And it keeps fracturing and fracturing and fracturing. And it's very interesting to, I call it, you know, we're all in our silos. When the economic crisis hit, we had nothing to say because our silos are bereft of answers about Wall Street. We don't look at Wall Street in our silos. We don't look at, you know, mass unemployment. That was supposed to be over, never happen again. And what the kids are doing in occupying Wall Street is they're basically breaking down the silos because now when people come, they can't come with their own issue. They can't come with their own agenda. They're coming into something much broader, which is precisely what we need. To me, that's the most refreshing thing. They don't care about our silos. They don't care about our 501c3s and our fundraising concerns or anything like that. They just don't care. I think they feel abused, left out, and rightfully so. We're all left out.
Well, Les Leopold, interesting you should say that. I just got a note the other day from a young listener who I was doing an interview with, Chris Hedges, and who was saying that those that don't step up, you're either a slave or a rebel, and if you don't step out and try and take the country back from the oligarchs, you're complicit with evil. And this young woman wrote to me and said, well, look, you know, I got student debt. You older guys aren't giving us any focus, any direction. Frankly, all I ever get from any progressive organization or the Democratic Party are solicitations for money. And I don't have any money, but I got a lot of energy and ideas. That seems to be the tragedy, that the professional left, to use a pejorative quote, they only seem to be interested in money, not in energy and ideas and youth.
Well, you know, we're all going to get a rude awakening because either this thing gets built up and flourishes or we're all going to head backwards. I mean, what are we going to do? Is our big cause going to be the re-election of Obama and the Democrats? That's some big progressive movement forward. These kids are way ahead of us. We need to get bodies out. I want to say this as clearly as I can. Bodies have to show up at these sites, whether it's for an hour, a day, you know, if you're young enough and you can sleep on the concrete overnight, terrific. But we have to build these up. Labor has to turn out bodies. Environmental organizations have to turn out bodies. Churches have to turn out bodies. You know, I too have been getting a lot of fundraising notes sort of implying that these groups are doing things, you know, for the occupiers. And my only response is it's kind of unseemly to raise money on the backs of these kids that don't have any money. But on top of that, the only thing you should be raising money for is turning people out for these demonstrations. I mean, hopefully in the future, you know, maybe you'll be broadcasting from one.
Yeah. Let me again remind the audience that I'm speaking with Les Leopold, who serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. We're talking about how other organizations are joining in the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations. Of course, during this week in Washington, Les, there's been a conference hosted by the Campaign for America's Future, Take Back the American Dream. And they actually segued into the Wall Street occupation, Occupy Wall Street movement, because to some extent the movement's got the jump on them. But Van Jones, who was formerly an advisor in the White House, who got driven out of the White House by Glenn Beck, he said, "I'm not mad at the Tea Party. I'm not mad at them for being so loud. I'm mad at us for being so quiet. They're not wrong to stand up for what they believe in, silly as it is. We've been wrong. We have the wrong theory of the presidency. We went from having a movement to a movie, as if the movement we were part of was based on a slogan called 'Yes, He Can.' I believe it was called 'Yes, We Can.'" What's your response to that?
Well, some of us have been saying that since before Obama was elected. And I'm glad that Van Jones is saying that now. Better late than never. But we needed that 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, because this was obvious what was going to happen. Without a mobilized populist force, the politics were going to drift to the right, because there was going to be all the pressure was going to be coming from the other side, not from us. That's number one. Number two, I really respect the Campaign for America Future people, and I've written for them, and I respect Van Jones. They should have had their conference out on the street. The currency of populism are bodies in the street. That's the currency. That's what counts. We could get a virtuous media cycle going here. More bodies, more media coverage, more bodies, more media coverage. That's how these things grow. And even though half the reporters out there end up interviewing themselves, that's a different story. But it's one of the only good things the mass media has done in the last, many years. They're actually covering this thing. I'm surprised.
Well, but not, but let's remember, they covered the Tea Party movement with such sycophancy and even didn't really go after the Tea Party when they were displaying racist outrages and provoking violence and running around with assault rifles. There was never any real sense of putting this in the context of these people. Who are these people? I mean, what do they want?
That's your job, not theirs. They'll never do that.
But I'm saying that a lot of what the mainstream press have been saying about these protesters in Zuccotti Park is, you know, they don't have a message. All this stuff about, which is essentially...
they have one message that resonates across the country. The 1% versus the 99%. The financial elites versus the rest of us. The rest of the agenda doesn't matter. That's what's unifying all this. And the labor movement has to get on board, and all the various progressive groups have to get on board with that message, because it's a winner. I know it's a winner, because a lunatic like me can write a book about this and actually get asked to be on very straight shows, because the message resonates. I've been on conservative shows right before Rush, and the narrators have trouble handling the argument because their callers are calling up and agreeing with it. The argument is a winner. Now, the kids are going to prove it to us, but we have to build it. The rest of us have to actually get bodies there. Those who have organizational ability have to turn out the bodies. If you're going to have a conference, you got to spend some time taking your whole conference to those sites. You can't just talk about it from a distance. You have to show up. That's the currency of populism. You have to actually show up.
Well, I'm showing up tomorrow at the one down here in L.A.
Oh, I knew you would.
So we'll see.
We've been talking about this for how long now?
I know. Well, I'm just astounded, because I always thought this is a fairly egalitarian country. At least that's the mythology of America, and that the Americans have a sense of fairness. And things are getting so unfair. They're actually getting cruel and nasty.
Hedge fund guys make $2 million an hour, and America doesn't know it.
Well, Les, I thank you for joining us here.
Sure, my pleasure.
And we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, we sure will. Thank you.
Thanks. Again, I've been speaking with Les Leopold, who co-founded and directs two non-profit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. He is the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. We're going to take a brief station break now, and we'll be back talking about the how China and Russia vetoed the UN resolution to get tougher on the murderous Assad clan, and how this may well lead to armed struggle. You know I ain't no clown, cause these damn blue-collar tweakers are the backbone of this town. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Radwan Ziadeh, who's the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He also co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously, he was editor-in-chief of Tihrat magazine, the secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Radwan Ziadeh.
Thank you for having me.
The veto in the United Nations by Russia and China, I suppose, was not a surprise or unexpected, but clearly the European powers and the United States are furious with the Russians and the Chinese. In fact, Susan Rice, the U.S. representative, said that Russia and China would rather sell arms to this murderous regime than protect the Syrian people.
Unfortunately, the veto who been practiced by Russia and China sent the wrong message to the Syrian regime and to the Syrian people, because it gives the regime the green light to continue the killings. Because it will say, he will say that they are being protected by the international community and the Security Council cannot take action. At the same time, the people of Syria being frustrated about the lack of actions of the international community. It has been 7 months with no stop of protest every day, and the regime is continuing the killings. And they are actually waiting for a strong position of the international community and the Security Council. But unfortunately, the Security Council failed without any resolution, even that condemned the violence against the protesters in Syria.
So, but do the Syrian people know this? I mean, there's obviously a press blackout, and you have the state media that is a propaganda machine. But are the Syrian people getting other information from the rest of the world, and they know it's not the world that's not protecting them, it's Russia and China that's preventing the action?
Of course they know. The Syrian people, they are actually following up what's going on in Syria through the media, through Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, CNN, and other international channels. And they know exactly, and they've been protesting against the Russian position and the Chinese positions in every Friday. They've been burning the Russian flags, the Chinese flags, and actually what's happened, the veto of Russia and China will galvanize the public opinion more in Syria against the two countries, Russia and China. And I don't think that any of the protesters on the ground have any doubt that the support of the Russian regime to the Syrian regime, that means both they are led by dictatorships, and this is why they have the same interests and the same values.
So, Radwan Ziadeh, again, the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. About 3,000 Syrians, as much as we know, have been killed by their own government, by the security services, the intelligence services, and the military, led by the brother of the dictator, Maher Assad, who heads up the 4th Division, and the Republican Guards. And apparently, he's coordinating all of this killing. But my understanding is that a lot of what's happening now is that Syrian army units are defecting, perhaps in small numbers, because the Alawites control the army completely. And it's very difficult. I mean, any military officer or enlisted soldier in the Syrian army has a terrible choice, you know, to kill their own people or to be shot in the back by Maher Assad's thugs. Where does that stand, the control of the Alawites of the military?
Unfortunately, that there is no difference between Bashar al-Assad and his brother Maher al-Assad. Even that Maher al-Assad being seen right now the dirty face of or the ugly face of the dirty job in Syria, but being collaborating and coordinating with all of these kings and torturing the people through with his brother Bashar. This is why the Syrian people actually, they do understand, since Syria under more than 47 years under state of emergency. and being controlled, the state being controlled by the security forces. We have more than main administrations for the security forces. And you cannot actually enter any newspaper without getting their permission. This is why they surprised when the regime propaganda repeating every day that the killings are being done by the armed gangs. And nobody understands who is this armed gangs and where are they coming from. This is the regime himself, they know the truth, but they need actually trying to confuse the international community and to confuse the Syrian people. But everyone knows exactly that Bashar al-Assad, along with his brother Maher al-Assad, both are responsible on the killings.
And the armed gangs are that the government is trying to demonize, are they defecting military units?
There are defections among the army every day on different levels, but mostly on the low-ranking levels and the middle-ranking levels. There is no defection in the high-ranking levels because there is no safe zone. This is why the people, they start calling and asking for no-fly zone and for safe zone along with the borders with Turkey. Because this is will be actually encourage more army officers to defect, because they will and to organize themselves and start to liberate other cities in Syria. Unfortunately, that it has been 7 months, and the way that the people keep it peaceful is not worked out with the regime, and now the people after the example of Libya, more encouraged to take weapons and start fighting against the Assad militias.
So when you call for a no-fly zone, that is a military intervention which would involve foreign powers, and that changes the entire nature of what's been happening so far. It's been a Syrian revolution against its own dictatorship that this particular family and this clan believe they have the divine right to rule Syria forever. And they will do anything to hold on to power. And clearly, Russia and China's veto at the United Nations is a preemptive move to prevent this beginning of arming the Syrian opposition, or at least helping the military units who are defecting. So are you saying, Radwan Ziadeh, that this struggle is changing now into an armed struggle, or it will change into an armed struggle?
Unfortunately, that more people right now, they've been actually start talking about taking arms to defend themselves after the high number of the killing and the case of the rape being actually increased in the city of Homs. But still the overwhelming of the protest in Syria is still peaceful. But I'm saying that it cannot stay for long, since the regime is not giving any chance to stop the killings for the peaceful protest. And this is why, and the responsibility of the international community, the lack of action, the lack of action of the international community, of course, will radicalize also the people on the ground. And this is how we have been witnessing that after the failure of the Security Council to adopt the resolution.
Well, the Turkish government seems to be stepping in, given the failure. Now, the Europeans and the United States have imposed sanctions, and apparently those sanctions are affecting the elite in Syria and the merchant class who the Assad regime have essentially bought off. So, obviously, they're starting to bite a little bit. The Turkish government have announced that they're going to send military units down to the border and conduct military maneuvers. Are the Turks going to create a kind of safe zone on the borders for Syrian...
The Turks actually will be play the critical role here in Syria, because the Turks, they have the longest border with the Syrians, and they always already been engaged by putting sanctions on the Assad regime. And maybe they announce more sanctions soon. And the people, they are actually in Syria, they looking for more role of the Turkish leadership. This is why I expected that if Turkey can play a role, that role will be respected by the Syrian people and by the public opinion of the Arab world.
So what do you expect to happen then with these Turkish military maneuvers on the border? I understand that on the border with Iraq and Syria, in Al-Anbar province of Iraq, there's a lot of sympathy for the rebellion inside of Syria. Is it likely that you're going to have sanctuaries across the border, and will there be eventually cross-border military action, and will the rebels find sanctuary and then find arms as well?
Most probably this is, will be the case. This is, will be the case, and because we in April we expected more actually restriction of the army to play a different role. As we know, in Tunisia and Egypt, the army played the important role. Refused to open the fire on the protesters and enforce the president to step down. This is not the case in Syria. You can see that in Libya, that part of the army, along with the part of who've been defected, start organizing the rebels and start attacking the Qaddafi militias. I think that we are entering in the same road, unfortunately.
Well, the difference between Syria and Libya would be that in the case of Syria, NATO will not intervene. I don't think that's a realistic expectation, is it?
Will not intervene, but we have to wait. Maybe that the Arab League will push for that. And I think the situation on the ground is escalating. This is, will be a change in the role of the NATO, and nobody expected that the NATO would intervene in Libya. But after the pressure from the Arab League, I think the NATO agreed through the Security Council to intervene in Libya. And maybe we expected the same in Syria.
So would this then lead to a kind of regional confrontation? If you have Saudi Arabia's already expressed its disgust with the Assad regime, and they're obviously in solidarity with the rebellion in Syria, the Turks are moving their military to the border and conducting maneuvers. The Arab League is likely to support the rebellion. The US, Israel, and NATO seem to be on the sidelines. But you've got Iran supporting Assad. So just walk us through whether this will become a regional proxy war.
I don't think Iran actually will intervene in any way supporting or backing the Syrian regime militarily. We have been, this question has been raised before with the fight between Hezbollah and the Israeli. And the Iranian at that time stayed silent, despite of sending maybe weapons to the Hezbollah through back channels. But here's the same. It's not among the Iranian interests actually to intervene to support the Assad regime, where that the Assad is continuing the people. This is why I don't expect that will be an regional fighting between the regional powers, rather than it will be actually more focused on the domestic issues in Syria.
So what do you expect to happen in real terms? Because the unarmed protesters have been massacred by the government. 3,000 have been killed at least. Thousands more have been detained. And we know that this regime is capable of the most hideous torture. You have units of the military trying to escape from within the bubble that the Alawite officer corps creates, where they lock them down inside their barracks. Somehow their smaller units are managing to defect. They're going to go into Turkey, and there'll be an armed rebellion that'll be sort of a nurtured, if you will, on the in these safe zones on the border, and that will lead to a kind of a civil war. Is that? I'm just trying to sketch out where things are likely to go. Can you add to that scenario?
It's very early, actually, to predict such kind of things. Syria has no history of civil war before. And this is why maybe the regime even that is investing on the civil war.
Well, isn't the regime encouraging ethnic divisions? Isn't it playing the...
Exactly, because the overwhelming of the Shabiha, the thugs, and the security are Alawite. Those who are carrying out the killings, carrying out the torture. But after actually 6 months of the people who are resisting against any kind of ethnic fight, I think that at the end that all the regime propaganda will fail and the unity of the Syrian people will prevail. It's not an easy. This is why the international community has to take actions. Otherwise, actually, the chaos in Syria will spread all over the region.
Well, just in closing, Radwan Ziadeh, what should the international community do, notwithstanding the veto in the Security Council by the Russians and the Chinese?
I think the United States and Europe has to think if they cannot get that resolution adopted by the Security Council, maybe they have to intervene alone, as they did in Kosovo and in Bosnia before. If we got the support of the Arab League, and the Russia is still resisting, actually there is no reason for the international community, the EU and the US, to intervene alone.
Again, I've been speaking with Radwan Ziadeh, the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He also co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously, he was editor-in-chief of Tehrat Magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began and went to Zuccotti Park, where the demonstrations by the Occupy Wall Street have grown substantially, with unions and other progressive activists showing up to join the ranks. I spoke live from Zuccotti Park with a very interesting fellow who's teaches at the Harvard Law School, and he is the author of a new book, Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It, Lawrence Lessig. And he was, of course, hoping that this movement will spread to Occupy K Street, which is where all the lobbyists are in our nation's capital, and for that matter, Main Street. And he feels that the issue that unites Americans, not so much the 99 against the 1%, even though that's a very effective piece of framing. He believes at the end of the day, to make a broad-based movement, it has to be around the simple fact that our electoral system is thoroughly corrupt, our government is completely corrupt, and it is all about money. And until we take money out of politics and make politics again about people and ideas, then we're doomed. And that was his hope, even though he expressed a great deal of excitement about this movement. And it may well end up going the way that he hoped. And then I spoke with a guy that actually does a lot of work with unions and tries to bring together unions and other groups, particularly environmental groups. He's a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. I spoke with Les Leopold about this, and I asked him whether he said, you know, the kids have caught everybody by surprise and they pull this thing off. And I suggest asking him whether the unions are sort of trying to, you know, co-opt it or catch up to it and other progressive organizations. And he felt that this really was the beginning of what might turn out to be a real alternative to the Tea Party. The Tea Party, of course, being a largely astroturf movement guided by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey and funded by the Koch brothers. if the Occupy Wall Street movement moves to occupy K Street and occupy Main Street and then occupy the United States, with 99% against 1%, that's a very powerful notion, and that would be an authentic populist movement. And he hoped that it would end up that way, and feels that, you know, these professional organizations, whether they be environmental or political or whatever, who continually ask people for money and don't give the young people any direction, and the kids don't have any money because they all get student loans, etc. He says it's about time these people got out on the streets, got out of their conferences and talking to each other and writing papers, and joined in the street protests. I thought that was an interesting contribution, if you will, since I get a lot of mail to that effect from people who are saying, why do you all you old liberals keep telling us we got to take to the streets? And, all that the Democratic Party and all the environmental movements and every other interest group wants from us is our money, which we don't have. And that is certainly the case. I get tons of useless mail from all of these organizations, and it's all about soliciting this. So I hope they don't try and co-opt this Occupy Wall Street movement. I hope they actually are inspired by it and learn from it. And then finally, we talked about with a Syrian human rights activist about how China and Russia have just vetoed the UN Security Council resolution on tougher sanctions against the murderous Assad regime. And Radwan Ziadeh, who's the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies, he actually turns out to be a fairly important exile. He was saying that, essentially there is splits in the military, but the military is completely controlled by the Alawite clan to which the Assad family belong. And they control all the officer corps. They lock down all of the soldiers. Nobody can leave a base. But nevertheless, units are defecting, small units, because they have a terrible choice, either to shoot their fellow Syrians or to get shot in the back of the head by the security guys. But Turkey is doing military maneuvers on the border. He believes that probably the armed struggle is inevitable, that this government has made no effort to negotiate. They want to crush this movement and kill it off, and they've killed 3,000 people so far. So a pretty grim prognosis that, in fact, that Turkey and Iraq will be sanctuaries for armed resistance against the Assad regime. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up and also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.